Good morning. My name is Teresa. We're going to read this morning from Hebrews 11, 17 through 19, and Genesis 22, 1 through 14. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, "Through Isaac shall your offspring be named." He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. In Genesis, after these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went both of them together. And Isaac said to his father, "My father." And he said, "Here I am." "My son," he said, "behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." So they went both of them together. When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide." As it is said to this day, "On the mount of the Lord it shall be provided."
Thank you, Teresa. Last week, I had an opportunity to preach at one of Trinity's church plants, Strong Tower, and they don't have someone read the passage, and so I read the passage, and it made me thankful that we have people here at Trinity that read the passage for the person speaking. So thank you, Teresa, for doing that this morning. Well, my name is David Springer, and I serve on staff here at Trinity as the Director of Campus Outreach. And if you're new to Trinity, we've been preaching through a series on Hebrews 11 called Family Portraits. And each week, we've basically been looking at examples of faith from our Old Testament brothers and sisters. And you might be wondering, why did the author of Hebrews think it was necessary to walk through an Old Testament history lesson? Why take all of the Old Testament and kind of systematically move through it? Well, there's at least two reasons that I want to give to you this morning. First, these family portraits provide us with examples of faith. And more importantly, these family portraits point us to Jesus. Kind of letting the cat out of the bag here, but one of the things as we're preaching through this series in Hebrews 11 that we want to make sure is very clear, we're going to look at these Old Testament family portraits, these men and women of the faith, but the point is not to dwell on them, it's to move us to actually think and dwell about Jesus. You know, why is this so important? Why was it so important that the author of Hebrews would reflect on these Old Testament Christians? Well, because this group, the group of Christians, needed encouragement to persevere. You see, the church that the author of Hebrews was writing to was facing opposition and pressure from multiple angles, politically, socially, spiritually, economically. Now, and unless you've been living under a rock today, then you know that the church today is facing some of those same challenges. And we shouldn't be surprised that what the church was going through 2,000 years ago has similarities with what the church is going through today. So the author of Hebrews thought it was critical for the church to look to their spiritual fathers and mothers for direction and encouragement. Look, isn't this true in any category of life? Think about this for a second. Mothers, You remember what it was like to bring that tiny baby home from the hospital. And as much as maybe you hoped you knew what you were doing, I mean, I remember what it was like when we brought Abigail home, and I didn't know what I was doing. And you know what it was like when you had maybe those nights when your baby's crying and you can't figure out what to do, and you've changed the diaper and you've tried to feed the baby and you've done everything possible and you're just like, what is going on? And maybe there's cases where your baby has a fever. And what do you do in those moments? Well, typically, you get out your phone and you call someone, either a doctor or you call your mom or you call another mother who's been through it before. Now, men, you remember those times where you've tried to fix something yourself? You know, when you got on YouTube and said, you know, that doesn't look too difficult. I think I can do that. And so what did you do? You went to Lowe's. And you got the supplies, and you gathered them together, and you got home, and you laid them out. And then what did you do? You realized you left some things that you needed to get at Lowe's. And so you go back to Lowe's, and you get everything that you need, and you bring it home. And then you start to actually do what you set out to do. And inevitably, somewhere along the way, it becomes a lot more difficult, and it doesn't go the way that you thought it would go. And what do? Well, if you're me, then you go to Ace this time, because maybe at Ace, the people at Ace can actually point you in the right direction of what you need to do. And so, you stumble and you try to figure it out. And at some point, if you can't figure it out, what do? Well, hopefully, men, learn this lesson. Pull out your phone and call someone, whether it's a neighbor, whether it's a friend, or maybe it's just the professional. Like, we got to get the plumber over here. We got to get the electrician and take care of this issue. So here's the deal. If we recognize the wisdom of getting counsel in any category of life, why would we not see the wisdom of doing this in relation to our spiritual lives? You know, I work on a college campus and on the college campus, and so often I run into college students who are trying to figure out life and faith on their own. And I say this regularly to them. It was said to me when I was a college student, and I'll say it to all of you this morning. There is no such thing as a Lone Ranger Christian. You know, I think we've learned some valuable lessons from this pandemic. And one thing I hope that it's taught us is that we weren't meant to do life apart from one another. You know, this is interesting. Back in the fall, the World Health Organization conducted a report on social isolation and loneliness. I just want to mention a couple of their conclusions. They determined that social isolation can be as damaging as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. I have no idea how they figured that out, but they did. And then social isolation increases the risk of dementia by 50%. Another recent report showed that 2/3 of adults currently are experiencing social isolation during the pandemic. And 2/3 of adults said their anxiety levels have also increased during the same level of time. Look, whatever conclusions we've drawn about the pandemic, one thing is certain. People are not doing well. And this includes people in the church. We are meant to be together. And the combination of social distancing and Zoom, it has not been kind to us. Look, there are reasons why it's not as enjoyable to sit at home and watch a service from your couch. I have 4 of them, and they're about this tall and under. It was a difficult couple months when we were at home. It was not easy. Now, I realize that there are some of you who need to be home right now, and so we're glad that there's an opportunity for you to engage with us through the live stream. But the reality is that we need one another, and we need the examples of our brothers and sisters who have gone before us. So it's with this in view that we look to our passage this morning regarding Abraham and Isaac. You know, over the course of the last 2 weeks, Tim has walked us through Abram's call in Genesis 12, and then last week, the birth of Isaac in Genesis 17. And in case you were not here either of those weeks, I just want to bring you up to speed by giving you the Cliff Notes version of what happens between Genesis 12 and 22. I have no idea if Cliff Notes and Spark Notes still exist, but when I was in school, they did, and they were a helpful summary, so I didn't have to read the whole book. So let me catch you up to speed on these 11 chapters. And these chapters cover a lot of ground, actually roughly 40 years to be exact, passed between Genesis 12 and Genesis 22. You see, in Genesis 12, God promises Abram that he's going to be the father of many nations. And this promise came when Abram was 75 years old. And for 25 years, Abram and Sarah are unable to conceive and have a child. You know, I don't know about you, but if you've known anyone who's tried to conceive, but who's been unable to, it is a difficult thing. It's hard. My wife and I had a family that was close to us, and they tried to get pregnant for at least 7 years before they eventually, by God's grace, were able to have their first child. And it was difficult. I mean, every month being reminded of the challenge of being unable to get pregnant. And think about Abraham and Sarah. They've been trying to get pregnant for who knows how long, and then God comes along at 75 and says, hey, you are going to be a father, and you're going to have a child. And it takes another 25 years for that to actually happen. Tim covered last week, but earlier in Hebrews 11, we're told that Abraham was so old that he was as good as dead. And it wasn't until he was as good as dead that God intervened and said, hey, I'm going to provide a child for you. And Tim reminded us last week that God always gets the last laugh. And so he provided a child in the form of Isaac. So you can imagine, think about this for a minute, all the years that Abraham and Sarah have been longing for a child. And they finally get that child. You see, Isaac is the face of all of God's promises. And through Isaac will come the kings of Israel, and eventually through his seed, the Messiah. So the point of all of this and why I wanted to take the time to go back through this 40-year period is that Isaac was a big deal to Abraham. So here we are, another 10 or 15 years later, and Isaac is a young boy, and God shows up to talk with Abraham. And listen to what God says. He says, take your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I shall tell you. If you're following along in your worship folder this morning, we've got 3 points. The first one is God's righteous test. You know, it's interesting that both the Genesis account and the Hebrews summary tell us that God was testing Abraham. And you might be wondering, what does it mean that God was testing Abraham, and why would God think it was necessary to test him? And I think these are important questions to address. Here's really the crux of it. Was God testing Abraham for God's sake or for Abraham's sake? Well, I think it's clear it was for Abraham's. Think about this. Did God know the condition of Abraham's heart? Yes. Did God know how Abraham would respond? Yes. So who was the test actually for? Well, it was for Abraham. Here's an important distinction that needs to be made. God's test of Abraham was not about God searching for new information. It was about demonstrating the power of Abraham's transformation. I'll say that one more time. God's test of Abraham was not about God searching for new information. It was about demonstrating the power of Abraham's transformation. Now think about this for a moment. When is a test beneficial? Well, let's think about the COVID antibody test. What can a COVID antibody test tell you? Well, it can tell you whether you've had the virus at some point and potentially whether you still have the antibodies to defend against a recurrence of the virus. So a positive test, in the case of a COVID antibody test, it has all sorts of implications for us. You see, the test is a neutral party. It doesn't actually give you COVID antibodies. Instead, it simply exposes or reveals what's already there. Now, students, think about this. How do you feel when you pass a test? Well, hopefully you feel good. How about a driver's test? I failed my first driver's test. I couldn't parallel park. It was humbling, to say the least. How did I feel the next time when I went back a week later and I passed the test? I felt great. So here's what we need to see. God was kind to test Abraham. Listen to what the author of James tells us in James chapter 1 about tests. He says this, count it all joy. Circle that word, joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. See, your spiritual health and vitality, it can't occur without trials and tests. Tests are essential for both our endurance and our spiritual growth. Consider this, Michael Phelps, the 23-time gold medal winner, did he ever have a conditioning test or a time test? Of course he did. Does a surgeon ever get tested? Yeah, that's the whole point of medical school. Tests aren't evil. They're actually for our benefit because they reveal what's actually in us. So what did the test reveal for Abraham? This is important. It revealed true belief. Listen to what the angel of the Lord says to Abraham in verse 12. He says, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." So what did the test reveal about Abraham? Two things. He feared God, and he didn't withhold from God. Or here's another way to say this. I always try to simplify things for our children and our college students. Abraham was in awe of God, and Abraham went all in with God. What does it mean that Abraham was in awe of God? Well, it meant that he had a reverent fear of God. Where did this reverence come from? It came from the knowledge of God's character, which I think begs the question, what did Abraham know about God's character? Well, a few things. He knew about God's justice. Just three chapters earlier, God rained down sulfur and fire by destroying the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And he turned Lot's wife into a pillar of salt. I mean, those are pretty powerful illustrations and demonstrations of his judgment. You know, if last night it rained a lot yesterday, and if you woke up this morning and you heard that Winter Haven and Plant City were burnt down by God from sulfur and fire, that would be a powerful thing. And then if you actually got to witness someone turning that you knew turn into a pillar of salt, I think it would affect the way that you think about God and his justice. But here's the other thing. He didn't just see God's justice. He saw God's mercy. God was merciful by warning Lot of the coming judgment and sparing him from the destruction. Or how about God's mercy when Abraham and Sarah tried to take matters into their own hands? Tim talked about this last week, by getting the maidservant Hagar pregnant. God could have said, I'm done. I'm moving on. I'm going to choose someone else to have a son through. And yet God's mercy and compassion was demonstrated toward Abraham. Or how about God's faithfulness? Tim showed us last week God's incredible, miraculous provision to open up Sarah's womb so that they could have a child. You see, God's character, when we look at God and we watch him and observe him, it should lead us to worship. Now, I hope this isn't news to you, but we live in a culture that has a diminishing view of God. We have put, you know, instead of examining ourselves, I think this is an important thing to think about, instead of examining ourselves to see whether we measure up to God's standard, we've actually put God on trial and said, does God meet my standards for what I expect him to do? That's really what the culture has done, is instead of us being on trial, we put God on trial. God is being attacked and questioned more than he's being worshiped. He's being rejected, and his words are being rewritten all over the pages of the Bible. And look, if we're being honest, God is being removed from the culture altogether. You know, I've mentioned this to you before, but sociologists are calling the coming generation the rise of the nuns. N-O-N-E-S. And this is because people are identifying themselves with no religious preference at alarming rates. Another recent study said that roughly 40% of both millennials and Generation Z, which is basically people 35 and under, have no religious preference. You know, I looked up this week and I wanted to see, what was it like in 1997 when Trinity was planted? What was the cultural climate then? Well, when Trinity was planted, less than 10% of Americans identified themselves as having no religious preference. And another study said that in 2020, 20% of Americans have no religious preference. So that means since 1997, the number of people that are not identifying with any religion has doubled. And what the coming generation is telling us is that it's going to double again. So, here's the deal. The lack of reverence for God, it's not just about the people outside of these walls, which we so often tend to think about, but it's also crept in here. You know, a question we need to ask ourselves this morning, how big is our God? Someone asked me this question, and I'll ask it of us this morning. If someone followed us around for a day, and I'm not talking about on a Sunday when we're here gathering together, but maybe on a mundane Monday, what would they conclude about the size of our God? Or another way to think about this, what would our friends and coworkers and neighbors not say about us, but what would they say about our God? You know, I think so often we want our friends and neighbors and coworkers to think about us, that we're nice people or that we do nice things, and we're not as concerned about what our neighbors and coworkers and friends think about God. You know, another question for us to consider about, are we in awe of God? What's our posture like in worship? What's our posture in worship? Now, I know that we are Presbyterian and we are predominantly white. So that typically doesn't equate with a lot of movement in a worship service. Not a lot of hands raised and dancing. But another way for us to examine this is, what's the posture of our heart and mind when we worship? Are we engaged? Are we focused? I mean, I acknowledge myself. I can come in here and it can be easy to go through the motions and forget about, what am I singing about? Why am I here? What am I doing? All right, I got a question for you. How many SEC football fans do we have here this morning? Anybody? All right, a handful. ACC football fans? Okay, a few more. How many sports fans do we have? All right, a decent amount of the congregation. So, how did you react when your team scored in whatever big game it was? Or when they won whatever championship they won? Maybe you're not a big fan, but you like to play sports. So if you play golf, how did you react the last time you nailed that long putt for a birdie or for a par? Ladies, maybe you play sports. If you don't, how about the time when your child got that hit or scored that basket or kicked that winning goal? I saw that LCS, just their girls team, just won a state championship, and I'm sure that the parents in the stands were elated when that happened. But I think here's a question we've got to ask ourselves. Why is it that we can raise our hands after a big score or pump our fists like Tiger Woods after a big putt, but when we sing about the Son of God raising from the dead to save us from our sins, we can just put our hands in our pockets and kind of mumble quietly? I think we should reflect on that. I mean, just yesterday, I was with my 3-year-old son, and we got this little trampoline for him that was to help him get his energy out, and he has a handle, and we decided, how many times can Hudson jump up and down on the trampoline? And that was our entertainment for a little while. And so we're counting, and he got up to like 243 times. And what did I do from over on the couch? Hudson, that is amazing. And we do that. We will celebrate things, but when we come here, do we have that kind of reverence and joy and excitement about worshiping God? Now look, Abraham, he was in awe of God. And because he was in awe of God and worshiping him, he was willing to go all in with him, which leads us to our second point, Abraham's ruthless trust. You see, God was going right after Abraham's heart by asking him to sacrifice Isaac. I want us to listen again to the instructions that he's given. Take your son, your only son, whom you love, and offer him there as a burnt offering. You know, if there was anything in Abraham's life that could have taken the place of God, it would have been Isaac. And yet, listen to Abraham's response. What did Abraham do when God told him to sacrifice his son? It says, Abraham rose early in the morning. He saddled his donkey and took two men with him. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went. The image here is that Abraham was on a mission. You know, I get this picture of men. Not all men do this, but a lot of times men, when you're going on a family vacation, you're like, we're going to get up early, the van or the car is going to be loaded, we're going to have everything packed, and we are not taking any stops because we have a destination to get to. And I envision this, like, that's Abraham's posture after he's just been told to do the most difficult thing that he'd ever have to do. He's obedient. Do we respond with this kind of obedience when God calls us to go? How do we react when God says to write that check or to talk to that stranger or to pray for that neighbor? Look, it wasn't easy for Abraham. He had Isaac with him, 3 days of traveling with his son, and yet all the time he knew what God had called him to do. And then we get to verse 7 and talk about a powerful moment between a father and his son. Isaac says to his father, Abraham, my father, behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they went, both of them, together. You know, just a gut-wrenching moment. You can imagine Isaac, Abraham's old at this point, you know, he's like 100, probably 115 years old, and Isaac is probably like, you know, dad's getting up there in age, got to check the list, make sure that he's got everything taken care of for the sacrifice, and he realizes the lamb's not there, and he calls his dad on it. Hey, dad, where's the lamb? I just imagine Abraham in that moment being like, how do I answer this question? How does he answer it? God will provide. And so Abraham, he believes that God is going to provide the sacrifice that's needed. And so they continue to ascend the mountain. And then in verse 9, they came to the place of which God had told him. Abraham built the altar and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. It's a remarkable display of Abraham's ruthless trust in God's character and his promises. I want to take just a moment to highlight a few places where we see, again, the focus is not solely on Abraham, but I want to take a few moments to learn from Abraham's faith. In verse 3, we see his obedience to God's purposes when he rose and went. In verse 5, we see his confidence in God's plans. I don't know if you caught this, but he says to the two men that are with them, he says, stay here with the donkey, and I and the boy will go over there and worship, and we will come again to you. What's Abraham saying? I don't know what's going to happen on that mountain. I'm supposed to sacrifice my son, but I believe that we will both return to this place. You see his confidence in God's plans. In verse 8, his assurance of God's provision. Again, I mentioned earlier that he knew that God would provide a lamb for the burnt offering. And then in Hebrews 11:19, this is one of the beautiful things about the Old Testament and New Testament having all the scriptures together. We actually learn something in Hebrews that we don't see in Genesis 22. And that's Abraham's dependence on God's resurrection power. Don't miss this. In verse 19, it says, he considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. You know, a lot of people read this passage in Genesis 22, and they say, you know, this sounds great. Of course, you know, Abraham, he was ready to sacrifice his son, but he never was really going to go through with it, right? Well, the beautiful thing about this passage in Hebrews is that it tells us, no, he was going to go through with it. Why? Because he actually believed that if he killed his son, that God would have the power to raise Isaac back from the dead. Isn't that incredible that thousands of years before God would do that with his own son, Abraham believed that God had the power to resurrect new life? What would it look like in our lives if we were obedient to his purposes? Confident in God's plans, assured of his provision, and dependent on his power. Look, if you haven't already figured this out, following Jesus is going to lead you to do some strange things in the eyes of the world. And we learned that from Noah. It's going to influence where you live, how you spend your money, how you plan your time. And listen, if you follow Jesus, your behavior is only going to look more and more strange as the culture shifts. If you want your behavior as a Christian to be more in line with the culture, it's not going to work. You are going to look more and more foolish and more strange as you cling to the promises of God in the midst of a culture that is running from the things of God. You can't have it both ways. So where did this kind of faith come from for Abraham? What was the source of his faith? Well, the answer is God. You see, Abraham believed his purposes were good, that his plans were trustworthy, his provision was never lacking, and his power was mighty to save. Abraham knew God and his promises, and therefore he was willing to go all in with God. You know, another way to think about it, Abraham demonstrated that he was willing to go anywhere at any time in order to do anything for God. So a question for us to reflect on, have we gone all in with God? Or is there anything that we're withholding from him? Maybe it's a career, a relationship, a sinful habit, an addiction. Let me ask it this way. What's your Isaac? What's the thing that feels impossible to live without? What's the thing that's so close to your heart that you can easily mistake it for God? Look, most of the time, it's not something that in and of itself is evil. For some of us, it might be sex or substance abuse, but sometimes it's the good things that become God things. Sometimes it's the things we don't have, like the desire for marriage or a family or wealth. And sometimes it's the things that we do have, a spouse, children, or our health. Tim Keller says this, so I'm taking from him, but he says, look, our hearts are idol factories. We can make an idol out of pretty much anything. I have a friend who has a son who is a world champion Pokemon player. I don't know if you knew that it existed, but there are people that travel all over the world to play Pokemon. And he's literally, it's taken to Australia, Brazil, all over the place. And so here's what I will say. If you can make an idol out of a little yellow creature, then you can make an idol out of anything. So what's the thing that when God comes knocking on the door of our heart, he's going to ask us for? You know, I've never met anyone who said, you know what I really want? I want a weak and wobbly faith. So the question for us is, how do we get a faith like Abraham? Well, we need to realize that it's not about the strength of Abraham's faith. It's about the source of his faith, which leads me to our third point, Jesus' radical sacrifice. You know, some people have wondered, why are we celebrating Abraham's actions? He was willing to kill his own son. Isn't that some weird form of maybe child abuse? Look, we're not acknowledging Abraham's faith because of that. We're acknowledging him because Abraham was willing to do what God would eventually do for us. You see, God wasn't asking Abraham to do anything that he wasn't willing to do himself. God knew that one day a time would come when he would give his one and only son. Except this time, God wouldn't spare his son like he did for Isaac. This time, God would offer up his son as a single sacrifice for sin. And one day, God's son, Jesus, would do what Isaac didn't have to do. You see, God was giving Abraham and his people a picture of what was to come. I just want us to think for a minute about the incredible image that Isaac gives us of Jesus. Maybe you didn't catch this when Teresa was reading in Genesis 22. Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah, where Abraham was supposed to go, is where Solomon would eventually build the temple in Jerusalem. So the mountain that they ascended to sacrifice Isaac would be right near the mountain where Jesus would ascend thousands of years later. Did you catch what they were riding on when they started their journey? A donkey. Who else rode a donkey as he went toward his death. How about the journey? How long did it take them? 3 days. Who else took a 3-day journey when he descended into hell? How about this? What did Isaac carry on his back? Well, he carried a pile of wood. Who else would carry a pile of wood on his back for us? Jesus, when he carried the cross. Did Isaac fight back? No. He humbly submitted to his father's will, even at the expense of his own life. You see, Jesus is the greater Isaac. This story isn't really about Abraham and Isaac. It's actually about another father and son. A father who would so love the world that he would give his one and only son. Why? So that we could be brought into a right relationship with God. Look, you and I are never going to perfectly obey. And our faith, it is frail and weak. In fact, it's non-existent without God's generosity toward us. Which is why we need a source outside of ourselves. If you want to believe like Abraham, if you want to have the kind of faith that's in awe of God and willing to go all in for him, if you want to have the kind of faith that's willing to go anywhere at any time and to do anything for him, then we need to do what the author of Hebrews tells us in Hebrews 12. He says this, the whole point of Hebrews 11 is to do what it tells us in the beginning of Hebrews 12. Look to Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, for the joy set before him endured the cross. You see, Jesus is the author and the perfecter. He's the one who gives it to us, and he's the one who sustains it. He is the source, and he is the strength. You know, if you're here this morning, and maybe Christianity is new to you, and you're investigating, you're trying to figure this out, I want to challenge you with this. You might not think of yourself as a person of faith, but the reality is we're all trusting in something. We're all believing in something to provide for us. If it's not Jesus, then my question is, what is it? Is it your own strength? Is it other people? I hope you leave this morning knowing that you've received an invitation to let go of whatever you're giving yourself to and to give it to Jesus and to go all in with him. If you're here this morning and you are a Christian, then here's my exhortation to you. We should do what Paul tells the Corinthians to do at the end of 2 Corinthians. He says this, examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. So how do we pass the test of true belief? I think we need to go back to those two questions. Are we in awe of Jesus? And have we gone all in with him? If the answer is yes, then let's keep looking to him. And I want to finish with this. What are we supposed to do if we recognize what Jesus has done for us? Think about this for a minute. We really were like Isaac, who were on the altar, and we deserve God's wrath and his justice and his judgment. And what did God do? He takes us off of the altar and he puts his son on the altar as our substitute. So what do we do with that? What do we do with this? If you're a Christian, what do you do with that great news? Well, you do what Paul tells us to do in Romans chapter 12. You turn around and you offer your body as a living sacrifice. You see, the amazing thing about the gospel, this good news, is that it actually enables us to not only give God everything we have in our possession, but it actually enables us to give our own lives back to him and to lay our lives down as a sacrifice for him and for others. So if you're a Christian this morning, let me encourage you to do that. What is your spiritual act of worship? Give your life to him and trust him. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for your word. We thank you that you have given us this picture of what you were willing to do for us. Thank you for the example of Abraham and Isaac in what it teaches us about Jesus. God, we thank you for Jesus and his obedience, his willingness to do the most difficult thing and to lay his life down. God, I pray that you would remind us this morning that faith is not about looking inside of ourselves and trying to muster up some kind of courage independent from you. Instead, faith is a gift that you've given us when we look at your Son and what he's done for us. So God, give us faith. Give us faith this morning and help our unbelief. We need you, Jesus. We pray this in your name. Amen.